Well, a warm good morning to everyone. I've been so looking forward to being with all of you again. I was with you in the fall of 2019, as some of you might remember. And it was truly one of the highlights of my year. The kindness that you showed to my husband and me while we were in Santa Barbara, I have never forgotten. And Judith McDermott and Joe Snyder and Mike Dean and Tom Heck and his lovely wife, Anne, were just went above and beyond in making sure that we were well cared for in our time in your city. And even the strangers we met on the street in Santa Barbara were kind to us. So thank you very much for that beautiful memory. I've been sitting in on some of the sessions that you've had previously in this Word and Life series. And the issues that you're tackling, the caliber of the speakers that you invited is nothing short of amazing. And I've learned so much from the other speakers and from all of you. And I don't think I would be exaggerating if I were to borrow a phrase from the novelist Paulo Coelho, who would say that you all are adding to the soul of the world. I think that's very true, and I thank you for doing that. This morning, I'm going to talk on chapter 11 of Love is the Way, a chapter called Toward a More Excellent Way. And also, as a longtime student of the Rule of Saint Benedict, I'm going to end my reflection by sharing a few ideas that I hope will be helpful to you as you begin preparing to write your personal rule of life. So I'm going to share the screen now because I have some images to go with my reflection. Excuse me. I'd like to begin by reading some lines from a poem by the wonderful poet Mary Oliver. It's a poem called To Begin With the Sweetgrass, and it's a poem that encapsulates many of the themes in Bishop Curry's book. It asks us to look at the world and at each other as a precious gift, with our eyes always oriented toward grace. To begin with the sweetgrass. Look and look again. The world is not just a little thrill for the eyes. It's more than bones. It's more than the delicate wrist with its personal pulse. It's more than the beating of a single heart. It's praising. It's giving until the giving feels like receiving. You have a life. Just imagine that. You have this day and maybe another and maybe still another. And if you have not been enchanted by this adventure, your life, what would do for you? I have become the child of the clouds and of hope. I have become the friend of the enemy, whoever that is. I have become older, and cherishing what I have learned, I have become younger. And what do I risk to tell you this, which is all I know? Love yourself, then forget it, then love the world. Mary Oliver. The theologian Walter Burghardt encourages us in our times of prayer and contemplation to take a long, loving look at the real. Looking deeply into reality in our current times, however, can be a frightening prospect. It can feel as though our beautiful, fragile world is in the throes of a collective nervous breakdown. We face multiple challenges affecting our physical environment, our body politic, and even our interior lives. There is the crisis of our deep-seated political divisions. At the same time, we are confronting a serious racial reckoning and a worldwide migration crisis, including at our own southern border. Add to that the continuing scourge of gun violence and the rising number of hate crimes and the constant folly of war. as we saw in the fall of Afghanistan recently. War devastates the most fragile members of our human family, like this child, Asad Hassan, trapped by the continuing brutal conflict in Yemen. If a bomb doesn't kill Asad, starvation will. Most of the children in Yemen are starving. Heartbreaking. Lest we forget also the threats to our air, soil, and water due to ongoing pollution, and as you well know in California, climate change. Layered upon all of these crises is a global pandemic that has cost millions of lives across the world. Sadly, there is also an interior disease tearing at the soul of America. We saw this earlier this year in Washington, D.C., when symbols of faith meant to signify peace, mercy, and love were used to justify and promote acts of violence, division, and hate. Who can blame us for feeling exhaustion, anger, and maybe even despair? This is a world crying out for what Paul the Apostle called the still more excellent way. As people of faith, as followers of the God of love, we are called not to despair, but to what the great social activist and founder of the Catholic worker movement, Dorothy Day, referred to as the duty of hope and the duty of delight. Day was fond of saying, "Even if I knew the world would end tomorrow, I would still plant an apple tree today." This was her attitude as she daily served the hungry, the homeless, the mentally ill, and the physically challenged. This was her attitude when an unstable man she was trying to help nearly broke her wrist, and when she had to clean up the mess after a person was sick in her Catholic worker car, and when she had to feed dozens of people on a single baked ham. Day's barrier reef against despair was a powerful four-letter word. The poet Emily Dickinson once famously described hope as the thing with feathers that perches on the soul. As much as I admire Ms. Dickinson's poetry, I feel that description does hope a disservice. It makes hope sound like it's made of fluff, something easily pulled apart. I like to think of hope as a rope made of thick hemp, the kind strong enough to moor a sailing vessel. Those of you who live by the ocean know that it's rope and not metal chains that are used to anchor large ships. A metal chain consists of several individual links. A single weak link can compromise the entire chain. But a rope contains the power of community. Even if several threads break, there are still hundreds of other threads to keep the rope strong and intact. If there is one theme that emerges in Bishop Curry's book, it is that community matters. Community paves the path brick by brick of the still more excellent way. Dorothy Day, after experiencing a rather tumultuous and individualistic youth, came to the same conclusion. As she writes in a famous passage from her autobiography, The Long Loneliness, "The only answer in this life to the loneliness we are all bound to feel is community." If there was ever a time when we need the strength of community, it is now. The fragile threads that have held our country together for 2.5 centuries seem stretched to the breaking point. And maybe like me, you wonder how and if we are going to be able to sew back together this patchwork quilt, this grand experiment called America. The COVID-19 pandemic, harsh as it's been, has taught us a few things. First of all, how interdependent we are. How differently I look now upon our mail carrier, the clerk out checks at the supermarket, and the people who stock the shelves, the UPS drivers, and the nurses coming off their shifts at the hospital down the street. I'll never again take any of these people for granted. The pandemic has also shown how interconnected we are in other ways. Just by breathing out, we can infect someone with the virus. And by breathing in, we can contract it. But as my Tibetan meditation teacher often says, can we not then breathe out compassion? Can we not then breathe in peace? That's our physical connectedness. Our emotional connectedness to one another is another matter. I once asked Sister Molly Brockwell of Mount St. Scholastica Monastery, where I am a lay associate, how conflicts get resolved in the monastic community. Her response wasn't exactly what I was expecting. What gets confusing sometimes, she said, is that we think liking is the same thing as respecting or loving or caring for a person. Well, no, liking comes and goes fast. What we aim for is a deeper relationship. One that says, we're in this together. There is something bigger going on between us. We can disagree with one another and not see that as a total betrayal or as a chance to hack the other person to pieces or view each other as a never-ending threat. We can disagree and not see each other as a never-ending threat. Sister Molly tells the story of an elderly sister at the monastery who was experiencing early stages of dementia. And here you see some of the beautiful sisters at my monastery of Mount St. Scholastica. This particular sister loved talking to the younger members of the monastic community, often asking, now, who are you again? One day in the dining room, she sat at Sister Molly's table and asked her how long she'd been in the community. Sister Molly told her, 6 weeks. The elderly sister smiled and said, you'll do fine. Only the nuts stay. There's humor in that, but also wisdom. We're all a little nutty, Sister Molly says. That's what makes community. Be the first to show respect to the other, supporting with the greatest patience one another's weaknesses of body or behavior. Chapter 72 of the Rule of Saint Benedict, The Good Zeal of Monastics. I often say you can sum up the entire message of the Rule of Saint Benedict in that one sentence, because the core message of the rule is that community matters. We see echoes of this in Michael Curry's book. Bishop Curry uses slightly more contemporary language, but expresses the same sentiment. And he says, to switch on God's GPS, simply ask yourself a question. Is this just about me, or is it about we? Does this decision serve only my enlightened self-interest, or does it somehow serve the greater good? What we're learning from science is that all of matter in its most fundamental state is relational. Here's one of the most meaningful images I've laid eyes on in a long time. Can anyone guess what this picture shows? That's right. It's the most detailed image ever taken of the inner workings of a human cell. And you can see how each cell contains all these intricate networks, all cooperating together. Excuse me. Linking arms, so to speak, a community. And even our fellow creatures seem hardwired for community. A few years ago, I visited a nature preserve in my home state of Illinois, where biologists are breeding a nearly extinct amphibian called the Blanding's turtle. These baby turtles, about the size of a quarter, are bred in huge vats of water. And I watched them swimming around for a long time. What I noticed was that as soon as one turtle climbed up on a rock in the water or a piece of foliage in the water, two and three and maybe four turtles followed. It was as if even these Blanding's turtles are genetically wired for relationship. It's we humans who seem to have the most trouble constructing community. And yet, community has been fundamental to our existence since the early hunter-gatherers and has been at the foundation of our faith since the beginning of Christianity. Basil, an elder among the desert monks in the 4th century, was once asked why he chose to live in community rather than in solitude. Couldn't he seek God more purposefully if he lived as a hermit without human distractions? Yes, the old monk responded, he probably could. But then he asked, whose feet would I wash? Whose feet would I wash? I don't watch a lot of TV, but a series I find both incredibly disturbing and incredibly insightful is The Handmaid's Tale on Hulu, based on Margaret Atwood's extraordinary novel. And some of you might have seen it. It's the story of a hellish world that rises up when people aren't paying attention to what's happening around them. They become focused in on themselves and their needs and their families. So when others, particularly women, start being classified as deviants or undesirables and are persecuted, it's easier just to keep one's head down, to look the other way, rather than to stand up for our common humanity. As Father Zosima, the mystic monk in Dostoevsky's The Brother Karamazov notes, what is hell? I maintain it is the suffering of being unable to love. In his book, Bishop Curry writes that as a society, we've developed a vocabulary for categorizing whole groups of individuals, labeling them aliens, illegals, foreigners, criminals. These terms fuel fear of people who don't look like us, practice our same religion, speak our language, or who don't live in the kinds of neighborhoods we live in or come from similar backgrounds. The reality, though, is that we now live in a global community. We know what's happening on the other side of the world instantaneously. We can send messages to the other side of the world and instantaneously receive a response back. There are no longer strangers. There are only our neighbors within a global community of which we ourselves are part. And what about others with whom we feel estranged? Members of our immediate communities, and family members with whom we remain divided by politics or personal argument. In Texas, it just became legal to report a neighbor or even a casual acquaintance to authorities who might have a different viewpoint than we have on the issue of legalized abortion. School board meetings have become verbal slugfests over mask mandates and what we teach our children about our nation's history of slavery. And we've all heard about the election officials in certain states who received death threats and ugly, nasty emails and text messages because someone's candidate didn't win an election, or because of some idea that something was stolen. Where will this all lead? Where will this all lead? As usual, there is no easy cure. There is one answer, though, and it is a hard solution. I return once again to Dorothy Day, who says it so well. If only we could learn that the important thing is love, and that we will be judged on love, to keep on loving and showing that love, expressing that love over and over, whether we feel it or not, 70 times 7, to be oblivious of insult or hurt or injury, not to see them, not to hear them, not to do anything but love, love, love. Dorothy Day. One of her favorite quotes is from John of the Cross, who says, "Where there is no love, put on love, and you will find love." We learn in chapter 11 that Bishop Curry is an admirer of the novels of Dostoevsky, especially the Brothers Karamazov. In fact, he cites a famous section in that novel, The Grand Inquisitor, which carries a potent message about how Jesus might be treated if he were to suddenly arrive in our midst today. Well, he wouldn't be treated very well, according to Dostoevsky. But I'm drawn to the scenes in the book that include the unforgettable character of the mystical monk, Father Zossima. In one of those passages, Zossima is approached by a woman who has lost her faith, and she wants to know how to restore it. Zossima tells her, "By the experience of active love, try to love your neighbors actively and tirelessly. The more you succeed in loving, the more you'll be convinced at the existence of God and the immortality of your own soul. And if you reach complete selflessness in the love of your neighbor, then undoubtedly you will believe, and no doubt will enter your soul. This has been tested. This is certain," Zossima says. But Zossima was also a realist and an astute student of human nature. In another passage, he shares the hard truth that love in action is a harsh and dreadful thing compared to love in dreams. But love in action is the kind of love to which we are called. It is especially necessary if we are ever going to heal the deep rifts in our current society. The great spirituality writer and Trappist monk, Thomas Merton, once said, "The need to be right is one of the most potent addictions of our time." And he also said, "If we don't see God in the stranger," and here I include under the umbrella of stranger those with whom we disagree, "If we do not see God in the stranger, we will lose the ability to see God in our friends." Well, how do we do all this? How do we do this? And here's where creating a personal rule can prove helpful. And I'm glad we're coming together to write our personal rule during the fall season as the leaves change color. Because what the leaves are doing in fall is returning to their true colors. Green is a facade, a kind of makeup leaves wear during the warmer months when the green pigment of chlorophyll masks their true colors. Writing a personal rule allows us to unmask the real colors of our true self. So what shall we put in this rule? It might be helpful to first consider what a rule of life is not. For one thing, It's not a set of rules by which we measure ourselves and then chastise ourselves when we don't measure up. Bishop Curry asks us to reflect on the Latin root of the word for rule, regula, which also means framework or pattern. I sometimes think of a rule of life also as a railing which we can reach for to steady ourselves when we confront a confusing or difficult situation. Another image I've found helpful is to think of our personal rule as one of those old-fashioned wooden rulers we used to use in elementary school. A ruler helps us write in straight lines on a page. Our rule of life, or spiritual ruler, if you will, helps straighten us out again when we diverge from the path we seek to be on. Now, in your handouts, I provided a set of contemplative values that have proved helpful to me in considering my rule of life. They serve as markers for helping build a framework for our rule. For instance, listening. Listening springs from being comfortable with silence. How can I develop better listening skills so that I'm not so concerned about hearing my own point of view expressed, but can be silent long enough to listen with the ear of my heart, as St. Benedict puts it, to even those with whom I'm apt to disagree? Community. Recognizing that we now live in a global community, how can I expand the definition of who is my neighbor? Consensus. Can I approach disagreements by focusing on those values and ideas that I share with others, rather than the ideas that separate us? Can I remember that each person holds some thread of the truth, slender as that thread might be? And that reaching consensus is not about winning and losing, winners and losers, but about building on common ground. Hospitality. How do I expand the concept of hospitality so that it includes not just physical hospitality, such as inviting people into my home, but also a hospitality of mind, what our Buddhist friends call big sky mind, so that we can be open to ideas that might at first seem strange or uncomfortable to us? Humility and simplicity go together. Humility from the Latin humus, meaning of the earth. We are all of this earth. We are all in this together. Prayer and praise touch on all of the values, as do silence and solitude. Prayer includes taking that long, loving look at the real that Walter Burghardt spoke of and that I mentioned at the beginning of this reflection. Observing silence requires taking time to be alone with ourselves, to get to know ourselves better. It means seeking each day to put ourselves in the way of grace, to use a phrase favored by the poet Mary Oliver, to arrive at a point of praise for what the poet calls this great adventure, your life. What I have set forth is a tall order. It's the sort of rule of life I regularly fail at, not because I'm lazy, not because I don't want to do it, but because it's hard. As the ancient desert monks used to say, the spiritual life is this: I fall and I rise, I fall and I rise. I also take courage and comfort in two passages in particular from the Rule of Saint Benedict. In the first, Benedict says, do not be daunted immediately and run from the road that leads to salvation. It is bound to be narrow at first, but as we progress on this way of life, we shall run on the path of God's commandments, our hearts overflowing with the inexpressible delight of love. And in another passage where he says, never lose faith in the mercy of God. Never lose faith or hope in the mercy of God. It is that duty of delight, that hope in love and mercy, that is the still more excellent way. Thank you for your kind attention this afternoon, and thanks be to God. Let's take a moment of silence to reflect on what we've heard, some of the images that we've seen.